today we have a special guest with us, a federal judge. His name is the Honorable Steve Boo. He is a gentleman I've known for several years, and he is a, United States District Court judge. So you heard of the federal judge. My son was actually sentenced by a federal judge, not Judge Boo, but another judge.
Wouldn't want that hanging over your head.
Yeah. No.
Prior to that, he was the chairman of the Jackson County Democratic Party for 4 years. And at the same time, a successful attorney here in town, and now a federal judge. How long have you been a judge, Steve?
Well, first, thanks for having me. I'm really proud to be here, honored that you'd have me on your show. I've been on the federal bench almost 2 years now.
All right. So getting some experience under your belt.
And still learning.
And you were, my son very well could have gone in front of you, right?
We have a random draw, so any case that walks in the door, you never know who you're going to get. It just gets thrown through the computer and spit back out, yeah.
All right. And before we go any farther, I have to take care of a little business here. Happy birthday to my mother today.
Woo!
Happy birthday, Mom.
Bells and whistles are going off.
Exactly. So she is 82 today.
Yes, happy birthday.
And Khadija, why don't you kick it off with the Honorable Steve Boo?
We're just going to start right off with our topic. Do African Americans get tougher sentences than other ethnicities?
That's a super tough question. We get studies from the Sentencing Commission that show that's not true. There's other anecdotal studies that would indicate otherwise. And on every case, the whole idea of the sentencing guidelines is to prevent that from happening. Mm-hmm. In the purest sense of what the sentencing guidelines are designed to do is to take out that influence of race or economics or whatever else and say everyone who commits this class of crime and who has this criminal history would get this range of punishment. And so that's, in its purest sense, is what the sentencing guideline is designed to prevent.
So what about it when it comes to this disparity of crack cocaine and powder cocaine and the time that you get for that? Is it any different for the two, and why is it so?
Yeah, historically, there has been enormous discrepancies for the category of crime of possession of crack cocaine versus the possession of just powder cocaine. There has been an uproar in the community, justly so, about that discrepancy. It was almost 100-1. Now it's smaller. There is still a discrepancy, mm-hmm, of about 10-1. And there's arguments on both sides of that, about, why it's still under our guidelines, under the federal guidelines, not the state court, but the federal guidelines, why that is. And each judge has to make that calculation themselves.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, do you have the authority to go outside of the guidelines, or you have to stay within the parameters?
And that's one of the great things that has come down within the Supreme Court in the last 10 years. They are now advisory, and I think that's a wonderful thing. It's also a horrible, stressful thing. Some judges will tell you that their job was easier when the guidelines were mandatory, that they knew the day they walked in on the case they were going to give the bottom of the guidelines or the top of the guidelines, but they really didn't have to give a whole lot of thought. Now that the guidelines are advisory, step one for a federal judge is to properly calculate the guidelines, mm-hmm, and then step two is to apply something we call the 3553 factors that really try to look at the whole person. A person is not, whole life is not defined by one bad act. And so there are other things that we're supposed to consider under those 3553 factors, the nature and circumstances of that particular person, the nature and circumstances of their crime, what rehab maybe somebody needs, what education somebody needs.
So you typically wouldn't be able to give a person a second chance, so to speak. I know a lot of times, and I might not be as accurate with saying this, but a lot of people that I know that have been dealing with drugs and issues of drugs sometimes get a second chance where they get a 90-day shock treatment and they're able to go on probation and go back into the world and be productive. Mm-hmm. On a federal level, is that something the judge has control over?
We do. We typically see what you're talking about, a shock time, mm-hmm. More on the state court level. On the federal court level, I do it all the time. If I've got to put somebody away for a long time, they're probably not going to get a big speech from me. If I'm putting somebody away and putting them on probation and giving them that second chance, I will make sure they understand that they know that I have given them that second chance, that we are going to give them in some sort of residential rehab program to help them deal with the drug problems. I'll talk to them about the options of drug monitoring that the probation office can provide. And then I'll tell them, I don't want you to come back.
So I have someone on Facebook who's asking, well, they're just basically making a statement that crack was in the hood and powder is a rich man's drug. Would you give that credence to the disparity of why?
That came from Congress. And, as we talk about it and see in presidential debates, people are still talking about criminal justice reform. And we saw that a long time ago where they just said, listen, this is what we, Congress, are telling you federal judges to do. And they believe that crack was worse. And there was probably some influence, and there's been a lot of debate about this. And you can read about it, published by the U.S. Sentencing Commission, that it was based more on fears of what's going on in, to use your word, the hood, mm-hmm. as opposed to a rich guy's drug. Clearly, more white people use powder cocaine.
Well, yeah, just for our listeners that are just tuning in, our guest this morning is Judge Steve Boo. He's a federal judge. And at the top of the show, Khadija asked him about the disparity between crack cocaine sentencing and powder cocaine sentencing. And what we're now, saying, the person online, thank you for writing that, is that generally crack cocaine is in the hood, is what this mm-hmm. listener is saying.
Absolutely.
Whereas most of the white folks are using powder cocaine and they're not getting as stiff of sentences.
Yeah, and just so we're really clear, I mean, all you're doing to make powder into crack is adding a little bit of substance to it and cooking it for a little bit. It's the same core substance. It's a cheaper version because you're diluting it when you're cooking it. You add different substances to it, and it's cheaper.
But then they're also smoking it versus snorting it.
Yeah. I mean, there are different means of delivery, too. But it's still the same thing.
So, a lot of times when we talk about drugs, everybody is lumped into one pal. You got the drug addict, and then you also have the distributor, the person who sells it. And so the drug addict often gets caught up in these criminal cases that become federal. Is it more likely that a person that gets caught up as an addict, will they get treatment, or is it more likely that they will end up in some institution?
Yeah, and you'll not like this answer. It depends. What I hear you talking about is two things. One, how a drug addict gets caught up in a federal conspiracy. In the federal court, we deal more with conspiracies instead of one-offs. Instead of a drug addict walking down the sidewalk with drugs in their pocket, that's typically going to be a state or municipal violation. What happens on the federal side is they're looking to try to get as up high up the ladder as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. And so they'll get somebody and see if they'll cooperate, or there'll be a wiretap of a distributor selling to somebody, and they're trying to figure out where the distributor's trying to get. Like we talked about a little bit earlier, the two things that I'm supposed to do is properly calculate the guidelines and then apply those 3553 factors, the more individualized, personalized looking at that person as a fellow human. And so in properly calculating the guidelines, we do two things. How bad is somebody's crime, mm-hmm. and how much criminal history they have. And so if the drug addict is a criminal history category 6, well, they're probably going to go to an institution. If they're someone, and we see this in almost every drug conspiracy, and it's enormously sad when somebody shows up, a young person, regardless of race, who's got a criminal history category 1, they've never really done anything wrong in their life, And they're not high up in the conspiracy. They're driving somebody. They've got a drug problem themselves. Well, those are the people that, for me, that I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for somebody that I can take a chance on to give them probation, to run them through drug treatment, and to use all the resources of the probation office.
I like what you say. You're looking for them. Most people would just be sitting there doing their job, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
well,
that's a good way to look at things.
Societal problem, right?
Yes.
And we as a society have said it's a crime. So now it's put on me.
Mm-hmm. We do have a caller on the line, but hold on, caller, because we really haven't told you to call in yet. But anyway.
That's okay.
We're taking calls now. And if you really want to be a part, I suggest that you get on the line so that you can get queued in. And the number here is 816-931-5534.
All right. And we do have a caller on the air. Your name and what area of town you're calling in from?
This is Imani calling in. I just wanted to make a couple points to kind of put this in perspective. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was the Congressional Black Caucus that lobbied to make the sentences for crack cocaine harsher than for powder cocaine because their constituents were asking for it because of the amount of crime that resulted from crack cocaine in the communities for those constituents. I don't know if that's correct or not, but I do remember reading that. And when you look at, you know, the fact that a lot of states are starting to decriminalize marijuana, and, you know, it just seems like such a travesty that someone can be a repeat offender for something like marijuana and spend a considerable amount of time in jail, lose their job, and get acclimated to the whole prison lifestyle and how that changes their life. I hope that at some point you have a discussion about Ava DuVernay's documentary called The 13th and, you know, really talk about how, you know, people are being warehoused in the prison industrial complex. And the last point I want to make is that even though it's the law and someone using or getting caught with a drug like marijuana, you know, it's against the law and they go to jail. You've got people who contribute to that, like HSBC was actually caught money laundering. Nobody went to jail behind that. Ali North, who, you know, did the Iran-Contra, you know, gun running. They used drug money to buy those guns to give to the Contras. None of those people go to jail. And they break the law. So, you know, it's kind of a very arbitrary thing to say, yeah, you break the law, you go to jail. It really depends on who you are and what kind of pull you have as to whether or not you go to jail. I think Ali North, his actions impacted a whole lot more people than some guy on the street, you know, with a nickel bag.
Thank you, Imani. We're going to let the judge go ahead and reply to your comments.
Yeah, good points.
Imani, thanks for calling in. You know, when a lot of this crack versus powder cocaine enhancements were being put in place, I was a little bit younger. And so I'm not going to be able to comment fully on the history of that. I can tell you that the Congressional Black Congressman, Congressman Cleaver, have been advocating to get rid of that disparity. And so maybe 20 years ago, that was a different effect. I can tell you now that the CBC is actively against that. I've only been on the bench 2 years. I can tell you I have seen no one who's come in with standalone weed claims. There's nobody whose only charge is marijuana. Now, there's some people who've been using meth and marijuana and have been distributing it and have had a gun, but I have never seen anybody come alone with just marijuana. And I just don't think that's a priority for the U.S. Attorney's Office to be prosecuting anybody with just marijuana. Now, that may be different in rural Missouri in a state court case. I don't see it, and my area is the western half of the state of Missouri. As to, I think, the last issue you've talked about, you mentioned it with weed and Ali North. There is no doubt in my mind after practicing law for 20 years that there are some very, very effective lawyers. And those people are usually more expensive than the ineffective lawyers. And I think that gets to the point that you've raised, that not everybody who commits a crime goes to jail, Some of that is maybe bias in the system. Maybe that is who gets charged. There's also some enormous impact on if you're able to afford an enormously talented lawyer who can bring a lot of expertise and talent and ability to the table, that will probably help you.
And we said at the top of the show that Steve Boo used to be a very successful lawyer here in town, so you know the ins and outs of the game a little bit. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about some other dealings that we've had over the years. Steve and I have known each other for 15 to 20 years, and he was one of the biggest supporters of my program, which was to give African-American youth a first job opportunity. He supported that from the beginning, and he's a good guy. I just want to get that in there.
Thanks for keeping my back, Keith. Next caller might not be as nice to me.
So, you know, I've been wanting to ask this question. We can have this conversation all day. I've got a couple of backup questions, but I know with all the people calling in, I'm not going to get them in. But referencing something that we've already talked about, and I'm going to give a picture of this, and that would be if you ever saw New Jack City.
I have.
And if you remember, they couldn't quite catch this guy on the charges, the main drug dealer. And we've talked about the victim, which in this movie would be Pookie, who at some point became an informant. And they gathered enough evidence, what they thought, to prosecute this guy on a federal level. Is that something that typically takes place in reality on a federal level? Is that a person is monitored and watched until they have enough to take them down?
And I'm always hesitant to compare real life to a movie.
Okay,
so
that's
fine. I'm gonna separate now fully from the movie. What I see typically happen, and I believe that our FBI and our drug task force, all I've seen is them trying their best to follow the law. But people are monitored for a period of time. If it's a one-off drug thing, that's a state court deal. Federal drug conspiracies are usually bigger deals, and they're trying to get as high up the food chain as they possibly can. And so you see drug task force and FBI doing wiretaps and listening in and always trying to go up one additional level. And so you do see people who get, you know, are at the very bottom level who are buying drugs, who they do try to turn into a cooperator.
Mm-hmm. We got a caller, if you want to take it.
Okay, I'll wait for my next question then. Caller, you're on the air. State your name and what part of town you're calling from.
Hi, this is BD. I'm from Eastern Jackson County. I was wanting to make a statement as to the judge's comments about a more talented lawyers helping out. If the law was the same, which I believe what the lady was trying to get to, if the law was the same across the board for everybody, if the law was the law, then the same thing would happen to that man that would happen to a low-case criminal. It's the interpretation by the judges and the prosecutors that make the system foul. And I'll get off here so I can listen to his address that point. That's what her point was, is that, yes, it's different for the people in the hood than it is the white people, but it's the judge's interpretation of the laws that give people like Ollie North and people who have talented lawyers off instead of giving them time and making them pay and do the consequences for the things they've done. Thank you for letting me make my statement.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for calling in, BD. I think probably that's on other people's minds. Judge, what do you think?
BD, I do appreciate you calling in. I think you've raised two issues, and that's prosecution and judicial discretion. And both of those parties in our criminal justice system have a lot of discretion. Prosecutors decide who they want to charge and what they want to charge them with. Judges in the federal court system are the ones who decide the sentences. I think in what BD's talking about is the perfect ideal world where justice is truly blind. And I think we all could agree that's what we want. We would wish that system to be that way. That is not the reality of our justice system. And I think the judges and the prosecutors strive all the time to achieve blind justice. But I think if we pretend that's the only thing that's going on, then that's not reality. Judges try very hard to ensure that their sentences are fair. And that's one of the important reasons why we have a sentencing guidelines, that they help inform us, okay, this is where the guideline is, and this is your criminal history, and we put that together, and it's an XY chart, and we see the recommended sentence. But I'm telling you, and this is, we all know this to be true, that there are some people that are more effective advocates. I tell my kids all the time, there's advocacy and there's effective advocacy. And so just because you're up there making the argument doesn't always make it effective. If you have the financial ability to hire experts, and there's people out there to come in and talk about discrepancies, there's experts that can be retained to say, well, here's what the average sentences are for this crime in your district and in other districts and around the entire Eighth Circuit or other places. There are folks who can come in and present a better portrait of who this criminal defendant is as a human. And there's some people that's not their forte. And so there are more effective advocates out there. We've got some outstanding advocates in the Federal Public Defender's Office. We have some very, very great lawyers that know their stuff and know their judges and know how to give nuanced arguments. I'm not saying that every public defender is bad or is ineffective. What I'm saying is the reality is we know there's some very, very good lawyers out there, and some of them charge $500 an hour.
Before we take our next caller, I'm going to ask a question, but I got a couple of people I want to thank. I want to thank the people who participated in the fund drive over the last couple of weeks. We greatly appreciate it. Also want to thank Banye Mims and Jim Nunley for participating in our Real Conversations last Thursday. They gave us a wealth of knowledge. And if you're tuning in and you want to be a part of this conversation, the call-in number is 816-931-5534. So I'm going to switch drugs a little bit here. I know we have a caller, but...
And I also want to respond to what the gentleman just called in about, which is I've been in court a couple of times, and one time I did not have an effective lawyer, and I lost miserably on a case that I thought I should have won. So there's no doubt that your representation does make a difference. Also, when my son was sentenced in front of a federal judge, not Judge Boo, but a different federal judge, he got the maximum sentence, or he got a higher sentence because of the escalations, what Judge is talking about here. And so it does make a big difference. The two, you know, lawyers, his defense counsel and the prosecutor, you know, they presented their arguments to the judge, and the judge rendered his opinion, and it makes a difference who you have representing you. And if you have a person of some means, as some African-Americans have been in the court system, we might remember certain famous guys that could hire, you know, really good lawyers, it's going to bode well for you.
I'm going to yield to the caller, but I am going to ask my question after the caller. I really want to get it out.
All right.
So, caller, state your name and what area of town you're calling from.
This is BD again, and I'm just calling back in response to the judge's answer or statement or rebuttal on my statement. That just sounded to me like, you know, sorry, you know what, some people have money and can afford to get off and some people can't. And that's not blind justice. That's a crock of crap. I should be able to afford my justice should be the same justice that's implied on anybody else in this country. And for a judge to make the statement that justice isn't perfect or, you know, isn't perfectly blind, well, it should, I agree with him, it should strive to be. But he has to acknowledge that just like police have to acknowledge there's bad cops and good cops, judge needs to acknowledge that there's good judge and bad judge. And some of the prosecutions in bed with the judge, and you see that deals go down all the time. And so there really needs to be a separation of the judge and the prosecution and the defense, because seeing the judge and the prosecution in bed making sentencing and doing the things that they do, that's what happened to me. That's what happened. So I seen collusion. And the judge was willing to say, let's make it lighter. The prosecution said, nope, we're going to make an example out of him. And the judge, I guess, said, fine, let's do that. And so I ended up with a much harsher sentence and a much harsher class felony than I would have if the prosecution would have let the judge do the judge's job. So that I'm just sorry, but as I was listening to that, it was just, to me, it sounded like, it just sounded like crap.
Well, we thank you for your input. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for calling back in. Judge, any further comment?
No, I understand BD feels like he got unfair treatment. I truly believe that the judges and the prosecutors and the public defenders all go to work every day and try to do their best job, and I see it on a daily basis. BD and I could probably agree on some things, that there are some judges who don't do their job. There are some prosecutors who don't do their job. There are some public defenders who don't do their job. There are some criminal defendants that deserve to go to jail. I think on the vast majority of cases, everybody struggles mightily to do what is right.
That's well said. And as I said, I hired a very expensive lawyer, and I didn't think he did a good job. And in fact, the counsel, one of my other friends said, you got killed because of your counsel. Just not good. He just did not do a good job of presenting the case. Just simple as that.
I got this last question, and I got to ask because I know a lot of people probably have paid attention to this, and this is Obama's mandate on heroin. We know in the 60s that heroin was a crisis for African Americans in our community, and it was deemed something that, you know, was really bringing us down. Now you have President Obama, who stated that many statesmen's kids and children and relatives are ODing on heroin, and it's called an epidemic now. What is your thoughts about, you know, all of a sudden, because we have the hierarchy who are, you know, now junkies, it's something important, and it wasn't before. And now there's special treatment being placed, and African Americans were once criminalized and still are being criminalized for the use of heroin.
Yeah, and I see lots of heroin cases, and what we see now that there's a lot more heroin in rural Missouri. We hear on the debate last night, people were talking about heroin and its impacts across the country. And places that typically heroin hasn't been before. And so this president has been doing things within the Department of Justice to try to address discrepancies and to address disparate sentencings and sentencings that were probably, well, that this president believes was too harsh. And so we're seeing folks getting out of prison now that maybe had 10, 15 years more on their sentences. I don't know if that fully addresses your question.
Do you think it's because of the sympathy he has for the statesmen, or is it because he sees an epidemic amongst all people? Because African Americans, as I stated, has had a outcry of use of heroin in our communities dating mm-hmm. back further than the 60s, you know? And so, you know, it's always been something that we struggle with. We always have been criminalized about it, and we have always OD'd on it. And so now all of a sudden you have statesmen, and it's an important issue.
Yeah. And what's going on in the president's mind? You better get Representative B'nai Mims back to talk on the politics side of it.
Mm-hmm.
What I see is that there are criminal prosecutions and that there is people going to jail, and I see it in mid-Missouri right now, that there's a lot of folks doing heroin and that there are ramifications for that within the criminal justice system.
Thank you, Judge. You've been a great guest.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed being here.
I'm a toot-toot to you.
I'll get toot-toot right back to you.
Your Honor, we are so indebted to you. Thanks for coming this morning. Thank you to my co-host, Khadija Hardaway.
You're welcome.
And thanks to Mr. Kareem for answering our phones for us this morning. This is Keith Washburn. We'll see you next week. And by the way, word has it that someday we're going to get an hour show, and we think that might
more
be coming up.
More bells and whistles.
We think that may be coming up soon. So we're keeping our fingers crossed. Thank you all for listening this morning. We'll see you next week at 9 a.m. And here is Stevie to close us out.
Goodbye, everybody.
On the next Sprouts, co-founder and president of Bioneers, Nina Simons, an award-winning social entrepreneur and visionary thinker, talks about far-reaching questions about organizing for systematic change amid convergent ecological crises. Thursday at noon. On the next Making Contact, Women Rising Radio takes us inside the movement for nuclear disarmament to meet the women on the front lines of the fight for a future free of nuclear weapons. From the U.S. to Russia, the U.K., Israel, the Marshall Islands, and Japan, these dedicated advocates make the case for returning to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and fulfilling its mandate. Hear their stories Thursday afternoon at 12:30.
This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
You could say that our justice system harms people who harm people to show that harming people is wrong. Restorative justice is a justice that heals.
It's restorative justice from harm to healing this week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectics.
You are about to hear award-winning journalist Errol Lewis discussing What Starts in the Streets, We Must Finish in the Voting Booth, recorded Saturday, October 15, 2016, at the annual banquet of the NAACP of Johnston County, Kansas.
For more than 116 years, of course, America's history has been defined and refined and improved by the incredible work of the NAACP, the world's first and still the oldest civil rights organization. No other group has had anything remotely like the impact this group has had in shaping our social consciousness and igniting the nation and indeed the world in the bold pursuit of equality and fairness. Growing up, I joined the youth branch of my local NAACP in a little town called New Rochelle, just north of the Bronx in New York. And I even competed, some of you all will remember back when they did this, I competed in the Act So. Yes, yeah. An unwieldy acronym that stood for the Academic, Cultural, Technical, and Scientific Olympics. I remember competing in that, writing papers and that sort of thing. And it didn't stop there. The habit really did stick with me as late as 2000. At a time when I was on a break from journalism, I ran the Election Day field operations in Brooklyn for the NAACP National Voter Fund. I don't know how many of you were involved in that. That was a special project that year where we specifically tried to pull out voters who don't normally vote. Normally, all of the effort goes towards the people who are definitely going to come out to vote, and then you try to persuade them. We specifically went into the housing developments, into the projects, into the places where folks were on the books but had not voted. And it was pretty tough going, but it was rewarding. The numbers later showed that we bumped up the turnout by about 5%, which can, depending on what you're doing, make a big difference. So I'm back in journalism now. I am doing a lot of commentary on CNN that you might see. 9 o'clock Monday morning, as a matter of fact, if you've got nothing better to do. We'll be talking about the run-up to the final debate on Wednesday.